It's time now for the Perspectives on the Power of We, presented in partnership with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee and the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga, hosted by Ron Harris and Candy Johnson, WMPZ, Harrison, Chattanooga, a Brewer Media Group station.
The following is a paid program. The views and opinions expressed by today's guests do not necessarily reflect the views of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee, the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga, or any of its employees and the Brewer Media Group.
Hello, everybody. This is Donna L. And I am so excited because you are actually joining an episode, Perspectives on the Power of We. But this is the final episode, a special limited series sponsored by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee in partnership with the Urban League of Chattanooga. And of course, I have the one and only Ron Harris, Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee. And I'm excited that we also have a new host joining us today, Candy Johnson. She's the new president and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga. Hello, everybody.
Hey, how are you doing?
Thanks
good
for having
see you
us.
Again,
hey, I'm excited that you all are here. Of course, Ron, as usual, and Candy, happy to have you today. So we're just going to step in. And Candy, I'm going to ask you, first of all, what are you most excited about with your new role that you're going to start in January?
Thank you for having me, Donna. And I am so elated. I mean, you know, to stand on the shoulders of my predecessor, the legend, Warren E. Logan Jr., and have so much to build on. I mean, we have a strong foundation of the brand around the mission of the Urban League to empower African Americans and enable them to be able to have a better life overall. So building on that foundation and creating this bold agenda for economic prosperity in the African American community, rebuilding Black wealth, educational attainment and financial security, so improving the lives of those in our community who have often been left out. I'm excited about bringing my background and more than 13 years of leadership experience in this space of equity, diversity, inclusion, and also changing community and changing lives, which is what the Urban League is all about.
All right, Ron. So I do want to ask you, did you know Candy before she joined the Urban League? And what do you see in the future for like the continued partnership between the Urban League, between Blue Cross, with the community? Tell us more.
Great questions. But before I answer those, let me give you a big shout out. It seems as if though every time I come here, I have something to congratulate you on. Mm-hmm. And so congratulations to you for being selected to the next class of Leadership Tennessee. Well deserved. You'll do well.
Thank you.
But in response to your questions, I had the pleasure of meeting Candy prior to her selection as the new CEO and president of the Urban League. We had worked together on several community initiatives, but also I met her before she was a resident of Chattanooga in Hamilton County. And when she brought a contingent of our public servants, I guess, from Clarksville, Tennessee. And so I'm just excited about the opportunity to continue our work with her. I'm excited about the opportunity for Blue Cross to continue its partnership with the Urban League and some of its really progressive initiatives, inclusion by design, the annual EOD event, and all the other things that's going to enrich our community and make it a stronger community.
We are excited about that, but I have to pay homage to the one and only Mr. Warren E. Logan. Mr. Logan is a pillar in this community.
Listen, Warren is one of Chattanooga's treasures, and it's been an absolute pleasure to have him not only as a friend, which a friendship will continue, but as a partner in this work. And in this radio broadcast, we've both tried to keep our day jobs, but I'll tell you, it's just been so wonderful, and he's been a magnificent leader.
All right. Well, Mr. Warren E. Logan, we love you. We love you. We love you. Well, I'm just going to jump right into it. I'm glad to have you both here, and we've got an interesting and timely episode planned. COVID-19 has affected everyone this year, and I'm sure is on a lot of people's minds, especially this holiday season. So for our final episode, we'll focus on the virus and the best ways to protect yourself for the winter ahead as well. And also, you'll chat with Dr. Andrea Willis, Chief Medical Officer at Blue Cross, about the vaccine and the role of the health disparities in the pandemic. And later, you will be joined by a panel of local experts, including Dr. Gregory Heath from UTC, Dr. Martina Harris from Chattanooga State Community College, and Bill Ulmer from the Hamilton County Health Department to discuss Hamilton County's response to the virus and the, of course, resurgence this winter. So we look forward to that conversation. Ron and Candy, thank you again for joining me. We'll be back to continue Perspectives of the Power of We after this short break. We will return with Ron and Candy. They'll chat with Dr. Andrea Willis from Blue Cross about the COVID-19 vaccine.
Now back to the Perspectives of the Power of We with your hosts, Ron Harris and Candy Johnson, only on Groove 93 WMPZ.
This program has been pre-recorded. For the latest information on COVID-19 vaccines, visit cdc.gov.
Hello and welcome back to the final episode of Perspectives on the Power of We. I'm Ronald Harris and I serve as Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee. And I have the pleasure today of also introducing Candy Johnson, the incoming president of the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga. So I'm really excited to work with her. Perspectives on the Power of We is presented by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee in partnership with the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga. Our guest today is someone that serves as our Chief Medical Officer at Blue Cross Blue Shield, none other than Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer Dr. Andrea Willis. She serves on the leadership team. Is also as a subject matter expert, as you would know, as it relates to health care. Before joining Blue Cross, she worked as a pediatrician and served the state of Tennessee as the director of Cover Kids, served as the deputy commissioner for the Tennessee Department of Health. She is a fellow with the American Academy of Pediatrics and a member of the Tennessee Medical Association. She earned a Master's of Public Health from Johns Hopkins School of Hygiene and Public Health and a Doctor of Medicine from Georgetown University School of Medicine. Dr. Willis, thank you so much for joining us today. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me here.
So, listen, looking forward to your responses today to some pretty important questions. So what do you say we just get started?
Let's get started.
I know you spent a lot of your year staying up to date on COVID-19 and vaccine development. The FDA recently approved the Pfizer vaccine and shipments have begun to roll out. Can you give us a brief overview of the testing and approval process for new vaccines?
Sure, Ron. Vaccine development happens in phases. Phase one really seeks to answer the question, is the vaccine safe? In this phase, it's generally administered to between 20 to 100 healthy volunteers that haven't been exposed to the disease being studied. If no concerns arise in phase one, phase two begins, and it generally involves hundreds of people of various health statuses and from different demographic groups. This phase really focuses on if the vaccine causes an immune response, and that's what we want it to do. If phase two is successful, the vaccine moves on to phase three where thousands of volunteers are needed. Phase three involves some people getting the vaccine and some people receiving the placebo. Phase three is to see if the people who receive the vaccine have protection against the disease. After that, various panels study and weigh in on the results. The CDC has a panel. There is an external advisory panel to the FDA that makes a recommendation to the FDA. And then the FDA ultimately makes the call to reject or approve the vaccine.
Wow. Thank you so much, Dr. Willis, for this great information. So I'm wondering, could you share with us, what does the vaccine availability mean for Tennesseans? And as a follow-up to that, could you share who were the first in the state to get it and how is it continuing to be phased in here?
So vaccine availability means Tennesseans have another tool to fight COVID-19. The more people that have immunity against COVID-19, the sooner we can start to emerge from this pandemic. I would like to remind everyone, until we get there collectively, we still need to practice safety precautions. And the first recipients of the vaccine within the state are the frontline healthcare workers. We definitely need them to be protected as they are in high-risk situations daily. And let me just take this opportunity to thank them for all that they do. It is so appreciated. Others that will be in this first phase will be residents and staff at long-term care facilities. And even within these phase one groups, individuals with high-risk conditions will be prioritized first.
So, Dr. Willis, how will people know when it's their turn to get the vaccine, and where can they go to get it?
Well, the Tennessee Department of Health has updates on the distribution of the vaccine on its website, and that information is updated weekly. And we at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee also update our website to keep our members informed. Providers are staying abreast of this information also. Calls can be made to local health departments if there's questions. And initially, hospitals predominantly will be given the vaccines because of the frontline healthcare workers being first to get them. And then pharmacies will serve as long-term care facilities. And as more vaccines become available, other healthcare providers will be able to offer the vaccine. Local health departments will too, as well as pharmacies.
Okay, thank you for that. So, another question. We know there have been multiple vaccines in development. What happens if more than one is approved by the FDA?
So far, the Pfizer vaccine has received emergency use authorization. The Moderna vaccine is about to be voted on by the FDA panel, and there are other vaccines that are in phase three trials that will likely be voted on in the near future. None will come to market without meeting the safety profiles required. And because the goal is to get as many people immunized as possible, we should just look at it as each newly approved vaccine contributes to the pool to accomplish widespread immunity.
So, Dr. Willis, tell us, how will the vaccine be given, and will people need multiple doses?
So the vaccines are injections given in the upper arm, and most of the vaccines will require two doses. The second Pfizer vaccine is given 21 days after the first dose. Moderna's vaccine requires a second dose 28 days after the first, and people will get a card to remind them when the second dose is due, and that information will be kept in a database. Now, there is a Johnson & Johnson vaccine that is still being studied, and that one will be a one-dose vaccine. But again, because the goal is to get as many people immunized as possible, it is advised that people get vaccinated with the vaccines that are available as the first opportunity that they can.
Thank you. So, Dr. Willis, what if people have already had COVID-19? Should they still get the vaccine?
So that's an interesting question. It is believed that the natural immunity from having had a COVID-19 infection wanes quickly, so within a few months. So there is nothing to suggest that the vaccine would be unsafe for those persons. But the recommendation is not yet quite finalized. If a person falls into that category, it would definitely be worth a conversation with their provider to determine what's best.
Dr. Willis at Blue Cross, you and Sherry Zink, our Chief Data Engagement Officer, I know you've partnered with Meharry Medical College in Nashville to study the role of health disparities during the pandemic. First, can you briefly define health disparities? And then can you tell us a little bit about the partnership and what you're learning?
So health disparities refer to differences in health and health care between groups that are closely linked with social, economic, and or environmental disadvantage. This can apply across many dimensions, including race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, age, gender, and sexual orientation. And we have recently initiated a partner with Meharry Medical College to combine our data to develop a COVID-19 vaccine refusal index. And what this really speaks to more broadly is the level of distrust of the healthcare system by many in minority communities.
So generally speaking, why have minority populations seen greater rates of COVID-19 infections across Tennessee?
Minority populations tend to have conditions that place them at higher risk for COVID-19 infections, and those conditions include hypertension, heart disease, diabetes, asthma, and obesity. Additionally, there are environmental factors that often come into play, like housing concerns, food insecurity, not to mention many in the minority community are essential workers, whether they work in a healthcare setting or in an environment like a grocery store. All of these factors put minority communities at greater risk.
So we hear so much about the hesitancy on the part of the minority population to take the vaccine. Why do you think minorities may be more hesitant to get the COVID-19 vaccine?
Well, there is some historical context that we can point to. The Tuskegee syphilis study is one that readily comes to mind, especially in the South. Those kind of memories, coupled with a suboptimal representation in the healthcare field by minorities, lends itself to a relationship between the minority community and the healthcare system. That relationship needs repair. We can look at the lower number of minorities even receiving the flu vaccine and draw some inferences as to what the uptake of the COVID-19 vaccine might look like in minority communities.
You know, thank you so much, because I do know that you are a big advocate of taking the flu shot as well. But as a follow-up, if there's one thing that you would like people to know about the COVID-19 vaccine, what would that be? And what else do Tennesseans need to know?
Great questions, and I'll try to take those together. I would say that approved vaccines have gone through the rigor of all phases of clinical trials. What is different is that we can't wait a long period of time between approval and distribution of the vaccines for widespread use. And I know that concerns people, but what should also be concerning right now is that infections continue to escalate. The healthcare system continues to be overwhelmed, and too many people are watching loved ones die. And that's especially true in minority communities. So as you consider the vaccine, consider it not only for yourself, but for those around you. The life you save may be a high-risk person that you love.
Dr. Willis, as we come to the close of this segment, let me thank you so much for your participation in this very important discussion as we continue to talk about community health. And thank you for your leadership as well. And we certainly appreciate all the work you do, not only at Blue Cross, but across the state of Tennessee. And on behalf of Candy and myself, we wish you a happy, happy new year. Thank you so much.
Thank you both, Ron and Candy. It was great to join you today. Happy New Year.
Same to you. Thank you so much.
Happy New Year.
We will return after a short commercial for a panel discussion on COVID-19 and its impact in the Hamilton County area.
You are listening to the Perspectives of the Power of We with your hosts, Ron Harris and Candy Johnson on Groove 93.
All right. Hello, and welcome back to the Perspectives on the Power of We. I am Candy Johnson, incoming CEO and president of the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga. And I'm joined today by Ron Harris, VP of Corporate Workforce Diversity for Blue Cross Blue Shield. This show is presented by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee in partnership with the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga. And I am excited to share that we are joined by local healthcare professionals to talk about the COVID-19 pandemic in Hamilton County. We have with us Dr. Gregory Heath from the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, Dr. Martina Harris from Chattanooga State Community College, and Bill Ulmer, from the Hamilton County Health Department. So first off, you all have been involved in Hamilton County's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Can each of you first tell us a little bit about your professional background, as well as your work and involvement in the county's response to the virus? So we'll start with you, Martina.
Good morning, and thank you so much for the opportunity to be here to share the stage with my colleagues. As you said, I have the pleasure of serving as a member of the COVID task force. And to me, it has been an opportunity for me to be able to transfer some of the skills that we have as it relates to the community college and the things that we are doing to prepare our students, and just being able to, again, help with the workforce of trying to combat this pandemic, being able to prepare students and educate students for things that they've never seen before in their lifetime, neither have I. And so again, learning every week from those on that task force as we try to mitigate the spread of this virus. So again, thank you.
Thank you. So Dr. Heath.
Yeah, sure. So again, good morning to everybody. And again, same as Dr. Harris, I appreciate the opportunity to be a part of this discussion. My training and background is in public health. I was trained in a school of public health in both epidemiology and then also in physiology and nutrition. And then spent my career primarily at the Centers for Disease Control. I'm not an infectious disease epidemiologist. I probably would be more classified as chronic disease or behavioral epidemiologist. But that's my background. I came here to UTC back in 2005 after 20 years at CDC, and I immediately gravitated to people like Bill Ulmer, who is in the trenches in public health, and that's where I feel the most comfortable. Was a little bit sort of a fish out of water in the academic setting. And so to go across the street and get some encouragement there and was really good. My role on the task force is I'm a member of what's referred to as the data analytics work group. And we essentially look at the data. We have a really talented young engineer who's been able to visualize those data for us by the name of Jesse Hauser. And so we try to inform the task force in general about the trends in data along and to complement, not to compete with, obviously, we're all in this together, to complement what the Hamilton County Health Department is putting out. And we try to reinforce that. We use their data, but we also go to other sources of data. So that's my primary role, is to help with that work group. And Tim Moreland from the city is the chair, and I'm just happy to participate. This is an unprecedented event in public health, and in my career, certainly, even though I'm not an infectious disease epidemiologist, being at CDC, I had seen a number of these things, and we get deployed various ways. And so this is amazing. And in my opinion, this is the interface between infectious disease and chronic disease. Because if you note in the pattern of illness that we see in COVID, essentially those individuals who are prone to more severe or critical cases are those that have underlying chronic disease conditions. And we can talk more about that, but those are the individuals that are most vulnerable. It's not just the elderly, but it also is individuals who are young and have those chronic conditions. We know from data that approximately 42% of the adult population in the United States has at least one chronic disease or one chronic condition. So that in itself shows us that we're a very vulnerable population as a nation, and the data is telling us that. But it's good to be
thank
with you,
you
and
thank you.
Having me.
Thank you, Dr. Heath. You all sound like a dynamic team. So finally, let's hear from Mr. Bill Ulmer.
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to participate in the Power of We program. A little bit about my background. I've been with the Hamilton County Health Department now for 37 and a half years, and have served as director for community health services. I earned my master's degree in sociology from the University of Pittsburgh, and then a master's in science degree in public health from the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. My career has included 7 years at the Alton Park, Nashville Southside, and then the Dotson Avenue Community Health Centers prior to coming to work for the health department. And then lastly, I've worked as an adjunct instructor with the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga for the past 19 years. With regard to the county's response to COVID-19, the Hamilton County Health Department has been on the front line. I've been assigned to work specifically with African-American communities, the faith community, and other subpopulation groups representing the health department. And then realizing that the African-American population is indeed a vulnerable population, I was tasked with arranging and managing COVID-19 drive-through testing at African-American churches for the months of June, July, and August. And I've had the assignment since then of managing flu shot clinics, drive-through clinics at African-American churches and Hispanic churches for the periods of October through December. Thank you.
True in Hamilton County, and are there other populations that are disproportionately affected?
Well, absolutely they are. Our Latinx community, these are our Hispanic neighbors, are really disproportionately affected by this COVID-19 virus as well. And working with that group of citizens and residents really makes for a challenging situation. There are language barriers, there are issues having to do with health literacy, and then there are issues that we can talk about later that have to do with trust of the health system and governmental systems, period, that makes it difficult for us to curb the virus among that population group. And so they have experienced some real difficulties with this COVID virus. And I might say, as we can talk later, that it's not just with the COVID-19 virus, but also with the flu as well. So you can also look at other subpopulation groups, such as our senior citizens represents a vulnerable population too. And those with comorbidities, those with underlying conditions, all of those are population groups, if you will, that represent groups that have been really hit hard, if you will, with this virus.
Bill, what about testing? Are testing numbers up locally, and how are we keeping pace and getting results to area residents in a timely manner?
Well, testing is definitely up, and it has been increasing over the last several months. Initially, when the health department began a testing regime, we were testing at one site. You might remember that it was at the Bonnie Oaks, Bonnie Shire Drive, right off Bonnie Oaks, during the early months of Hamilton County's addressing of this vaccine. That was back in March and then April. But since then, a number of other entities have been involved very actively, I might add, in offering and providing testing opportunities for our community. So at one point, testing was relatively limited. Access was a great concern. But in the early months of the summer, we were able to launch the effort of my team with working with African-American churches. We were testing on every single weekend at a different church, and we were seeing a lot of people, not just those persons who were going to that particular church or that faith-based institution, but persons from all over the county were coming there, as well as persons from out of the city and county as well. People from Bradley County, Dalton, Georgia, were coming up and visiting us at our testing location. So we're very happy about making testing more accessible to persons and giving the public great opportunities to get tests as well. In terms of results, Early on, we were experiencing some pretty lengthy delays in getting testing results back to those who were tested. And when I mean lengthy delays, I'm talking anywhere from 7 to 10 days. That was curbed when we changed our labs to the Path Group lab. And that particular lab has been producing testing results much better turnaround. We're talking anywhere from 24 to 48 hours, and that continues today. There have been some snags along the way with their changing of equipment and whatever, but the good thing about it is that the snags were very temporary. And so even as of today, the turnaround time is good. We're talking anywhere from 24 to 48 hours. And so we're happy to be able to get the results back to those persons who've been tested so that they can know what their status is. The thing that we need to remember, however, is that when persons are tested for this COVID virus, it is simply a point in time test. That persons can literally test today, get results back in 24 to 48 hours, and then 2 days later, they could be in a situation where they contract the virus. So people can have a misnomer about their test results. People have to remember that your test results only reflect your status at the time that you took the test. So we have encouraged people to just be careful with their surroundings, wear your mask, practice social distancing, and wash your hands often, and continue the other public health measures that we recommend. People were testing often, but we don't want to overload our testing regime. Test yourself and then follow the protocols and practices that we advocate.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Mr. Omar, for those great insights. So I want to transition to and direct these questions for Dr. Harris and Dr. Heath. First, I want you to address really the increase in the rates. So we know this was predicted that the infection rates would rise across the country and right here in Chattanooga. So part one is, you know, what do you think, and we'll start with Dr. Harris, has been behind this increase in cases? And secondly, talk about how the role of the COVID-19 Joint Task Force has evolved throughout this pandemic.
Okay, thank you so much. Based on what we've seen, and Dr. Heath and his data analytics team have been very helpful in showing us about the spread, is that we have recently seen the numbers spiked after our holiday. No matter what type of information we were giving out, basically the health department and all the other messages that were going out to say, please refrain from traveling, please do not have large gatherings. It was if people ignored those asks. And so we have seen a spike in the number of positive cases as it results after the Thanksgiving holiday. And so what we are now trying to do as a task force is we are making recommendations as to what type of additional media can we get out to the community to encourage them, to discourage them from doing large gatherings. Although we have a mask mandate in our county that, you know, we are wearing masks, but it's those large gatherings that seem to continue. And that's where we are seeing this. And you know, I'm going to say it like this, we're losing the fight when we see people with the large gatherings. So, Dr. Heath?
Yeah, no, I would reiterate what Dr. Harris has been saying, and that is, you know, we've been tracking this for now almost eight months, and we have seen potentials. You know, initially we were pretty much unscathed. I mean, we showed very little the number of cases initially, and I'm working with the health department very strongly, trying to, we had some of our Masters of Public Health students that and graduates who are now working for the health department or were volunteering to do particularly, you know, we're talking about testing, but also contact tracing, we call, and essentially trying to identify individuals who tested positive and get information about who they were with. And so with this current surge, it has just overwhelmed the local health department. And this is not, this is typical of what's happening across the country. And I think that the thing that we are most concerned about is that we weren't prepared for this. I think that public health funding in general has has not been where it should be. And we were warned actually several years ago, actually back in a long time ago, that something like this may happen. And would we be prepared? I think in terms of our current situation, I mean, I just want to reiterate some of the numbers here, just because that's what I do. But the disproportionate burden, you've asked that question, particularly amongst the African American community as well as the Latinx. Just some numbers here. So the proportion of people who live in this county, it's about 19% of our citizens are African American. About 6% are Latinx, and the remaining, there's predominantly white or Caucasian, around 71 to 72% of the population. So when you look at the case distribution, about 19.5% of all the cases are from African American. But if you express that as a rate, it's around 550 cases per 10,000 population. Compare that to the white rate, which is 419 cases per 10K. And then and the Latinx is 986 cases per 100,000 per 10,000. So the rates actually tell you more than the percentages. And I think that the issue here is, and some would say, if we look at the deaths are a little bit even more dramatic. African-American deaths are right now 72 out of the 223 that we currently have, 102 per 100K. And then the Latinx is around 54 per 100K. And then white is around 47 deaths per 100K. So the African-American rate, death rate itself, is almost twice of what you would, in terms of comparing it to the predominant Caucasian population. You might ask the question, well, how come the Latinx death rate is so low? I mean, it's still about the equal to about the white population of about 54 per 100 versus 47 per 100 per 10K. And the reason for that is that the Latinx community is much younger. This consists of recent immigrants and others, whereas in the African American community, you're looking at generations who have lived here, and looking at greater distribution of older individuals. And older individuals who are more likely, unfortunately, disproportionately, to carry chronic disease risk, and that is, as Mr. Ulmer said, is it predisposes an individual to being more vulnerable for this virus. And there's other issues around the health disparities. This shouldn't. It's not a surprise to those of us in public health. And that we see these kinds of disparities because they've existed all along. I'll have Bill and Dr. Harris respond to that. But that's the sad part of this. So going forward, things have to change big time.
Yeah. So thank you for sharing all of those insights. It sounds like the COVID-19 Joint Task Force is challenged with not only getting the message out, but continuing to ensure the safety of residents with, sharing the data and all of those points and facts about the virus. So we have seen and heard that many of the organizations that have offered the flu vaccine are also coupling that with testing and other things around COVID-19. So talk about the flu vaccine and the importance of getting one, especially this year. So why does this vaccine matter, particularly in the midst of the pandemic?
Well, I will address that. We're at a critical junction in our community. we're literally at the intersection of the flu and COVID-19. The problem is that the flu and the flu season has already begun, but the flu and COVID-19 have very similar symptoms. We're talking about cough, fever, headache, body aches, diarrhea, respiratory distress, except that with COVID, you could also have the symptoms of loss of taste and loss of smell. Persons can contract COVID-19 and then contract the flu, or contract the flu and then COVID-19. Some experts would even say, and has been reported, that persons can even contract them both at the same time. That presents a real serious problem for anybody. And if you've got underlying conditions, you're at a critical stage. We have the flu vaccine. We've had it. We generally have it every year. It's the seasonal flu vaccine. We've been trying to encourage the members of the general public to take the flu vaccine. Let's get that off our list. That will reduce your chances of contracting the flu. And should you contract the flu, you will be at a better situation in terms of your health status, as opposed to contracting the flu and not having taken the flu vaccine. So it's worth mentioning, Hyper, though, that our data is showing that we are seeing less flu this season. And we shouldn't be surprised really about that, because the same precautions that we advocate for COVID-19, we've been advocating since March, are the same precautions we would advocate for the flu. Cover your cough, cover your sneeze, wash your hands often, refrain from large gatherings, limit your gatherings to those persons who live in your house. So all of those things really have worked in favor of reducing the contracting of the flu and the spread of the flu. So that's a good thing, if there was something good. So we're happy about that, but we're still seeing flu because it's a community spread virus, and every year it's a fight for health officials to encourage and to get members of the public to take the flu vaccine. This is no different. And it really is going to be a challenge for us as we look to the COVID-19 vaccine. It's going to be just as much of a challenge. Many of the same reasons that people are giving for not taking the flu vaccine will be reasons for not taking the COVID. But that's something that we're going to have to address through messaging. And as Dr. Harris made a comment about messaging, and I know that the task force is really doing a lot in terms of that, community education, there's not enough of that that can be done. This is a critical time when all hands are on deck with regard to giving out correct and accurate information regarding the flu and COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, very well said. I mean, I think the issue here is what we refer is host resistance. And host resistance is to maintain as healthy a host. And what host being us, the human beings, is that what Bill's talking about, I think, is really key in terms of taking that flu vaccine to protect one from the flu, because that would lower your resistance. That would lower your and enhance your, if you will, increase your vulnerability. And so those kinds of things, as well as the other health behaviors that are associated with this, it's really interesting. Yeah, with masking, you're fighting both viruses. You're fighting the corona, and you're also fighting the flu virus. Essentially, you're being able to prevent the spread. I think, as far as the vaccine is concerned, I think the issue here is, and it's a key one, and it gets back to what Dr. Harris said, and that is that we need to understand that the vaccine is not just something that's just a point in time. Bingo, you're protected. But indeed, as a population, we need to continue to practice the mitigation behaviors that Bill so well described, and that is, you know, the masking, certainly the spatial distancing and personal hygiene. That's going to be very important. The other issue is the messaging around the COVID vaccine itself, and that is the importance of recognizing in order for us to have what we refer to as herd immunity, we're going to need to at least hit 70% or greater of the population being vaccinated. So this is one analogy of this, and I think it was put forth by Dr. Fauci, the NIH, and that is we all need to be in the boat together, and we all need to be rowing together. And that's where we're going to be able to defeat this thing.
Dr. Heath, I think that's great information and appreciate you sharing that. I want to talk to Dr. Harris a little bit about the Pfizer approval. So this is great news. It's still important for us all to do our part to curb the spread of the virus, which is what many of you have spoken about this morning. How would you recommend, Dr. Harris, that Hamilton County keep themselves and residents and their families safe for the remainder of the holiday season and into the winter?
And again, I will just echo what has already been said by the other panelists, is that although the vaccine is going to be begin to be distributed, we still need to practice safe hand washing. We still need to avoid large crowds. We still need to wear our mask. And so we need to realize as a community that the vaccine is only going to do so much. We still have to do our part as residents to make sure that we are keeping safe. So again, I know that it has been talked about that Pfizer is going to be the first one to roll it out, and some of the facilities here are trying to determine who would be those first people to get that vaccine. So there's still a lot of education that is going into who will get it, how they would get it, and to ensure that there is follow-up, because once you get the first one, you have to get the second one 21 days later. So there's so much to go to it. So we just encourage everyone not to let your guard down. Continue to wear your mask, wash your hands, maintain the social distancing, and help us stop the spread of this deadly virus.
Neil, let me just ask you a final question. The year is drawing to a close. So I'd like for you, you know, from your chair at the Hamilton County Health Department, share your thoughts on the pandemic in 2021. And additionally, how do you see it evolving next year? And if I can add a third part to that question, when do you think we'll finally turn the corner and get back to some sense of normalcy?
Yes, let me say this, that we're at that critical point. The virus has really taken its toll on residents of Hamilton County, because it's not just us, it's all over the country. The fact that the virus is coming, and some of it is here now. There is a plan. The Department of Health and all health departments throughout the state of Tennessee are adhering to a master plan for distribution of the virus. But what residents need to understand is that this is not the time to let the guard down. Because the vaccine is coming to Hamilton County. Remember that it will take months, probably the spring of the year, before most people can access the vaccine. We anticipate that this virus is going to be with us at pandemic levels for another 6 to 8 months, maybe a year. I think that the year 2021 will continue to be extremely challenging for everyone. Unfortunately, while there is light at the end of the long tunnel, we've got a long way to go. There's going to be a new normal, without a doubt. We don't know what it's going to look like, but we will be having to do things that and in ways that we're not used to, and we're going to have to get a sense of normalcy in how those new patterns of behavior look, because they're going to have to be with us moving forward until we are in a better state of health as a county, as a state, as a nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's been a lot of great discussion. I'm sure that we could go on for, you know, another 30 minutes to an hour. And hopefully the listeners have gained something from the knowledge and expertise that each of you bring to the table. We appreciate your work that you're doing in the community to help stop the spread of the virus and to help others stay safe and participating in this show today. And so, again, we thank everyone for listening to this final episode of Perspectives on the Power of We, brought to you by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee and in partnership with the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga. We wish you all a happy, healthy New Year. Stay safe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Perspectives on the Power of We, brought to you by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee in partnership with the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga.